Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about stuff that's in the theater. F9, the latest Fast and Furious movie, and also Summer of Soul, a choice from Sundance that I think was sort of a sleeper, and I hope everybody after this program will try to find out where this is showing and go to see it. Now, both of these are only available in the theater, and I would argue that both of them have an extra element to them that makes it worth seeing in the theater. So we're going to start with the Fast and the Furious movie, the F9, the Fast Saga. Now, I prepared for this by going back and watching all the Fast and Furious movies that I have not seen. Now, I saw the first two in the theaters, you know, when they came out, because my husband is a big car buff. And, you know, the movies themselves are, they sort of trade on their own ridiculousness. I'm sure, Mike, you're going to have an opinion about this. But going to see them, you know, I said to my husband, who I make sit through all kinds of talky movies and foreign films and all kinds of tedious things. And he will eventually at some point say to me, look, I need to see a robot or a car chase, because, you know, for him, that's what, you know, movies are in a cliche way. You know, where's the action? Where's the science fiction? You know, that's what he likes about the movies. Now, what I want to start off by saying about this F9 movie, the final, you know, the Fast Saga, is that these movies have been a franchise that's been alive for a really long time, and they attract an audience. And when the theaters opened back up after COVID and the pandemic and everything, some movies have been really popular and done really well in the theaters, and some have not. And one of the big money makers this summer has been this movie. Now, I would argue that after all the ones that have come before it, you know, one of the things I always evaluate a movie on is, do I feel like I've seen this movie before? And there's a sameness to all of the Fast and Furious movies that I think is mined over and over in all of the movies. So yes, you've seen it before. And yet I think there's a real argument for why this has gotten people into the theaters. There's something very satisfying about a big action picture that is meant to be seen on the big screen with the sound, and it sort of buries the outrageousness in the experience of watching the movie. Mike, what was your experience?
Well, picking up on what you just said, you get in your car and you drive to the movie theater and you watch a movie about cars as much as anything. I would make this distinction that the Fast and the Furious franchise, and I have sat through all of them, and to put it mildly, I'm not exactly a fan, but I've sat through every minute of every one, and we'll talk about the minutes in a moment. And I would make this distinction, the Fast and the Furious franchise, and it goes back 20 years at this point, these are movies. These are not films. And as a film snob, I'm always making that distinction. Nobody would say that the French director Eric Rohmer directed, you know, the Fast and the Furious films. You know, they're anything but talky. People do talk, or they shout occasionally, you know, as they're racing around in their cars. The stories are beyond ridiculous. There's a kind of meta awareness. By that, I mean, people know they're doing stupid stuff in a stupid movie, and they almost like wink at the camera sometimes, at least some of the characters. Here's one of my main gripes about them. So, and by way of taste, it's really not to my taste particularly. These are movies about cars and about family, if you will, not necessarily always biological, but it's a family of car enthusiasts, whether they're a member of a criminal gang or of the good guys trying to get them, whatever. People are bonded through the vehicles, if you will. And there's a kind of fusion of metal and flesh that way. I don't mean by way of car accidents, but just the way in which people are so enthusiastic about these vehicles and other people who have similar interests. And we'll talk about the story to the extent there's a story in this one presently. But the numbers I want to crunch are, and this will sound really obsessive, and it is in a way, having seen all the films, I didn't feel impelled to watch them all again. It was enough to sit through them once, right? But what I will say is the first one and the first several in the franchise clocked in at around 100 minutes, give or take. And what I've noticed is that the more recent ones have had longer running times. You know, the other side of 2 hours, the present film we're talking about has a running time of 2 hours and 25 minutes. Now, if you love the film, you know, there's just more to love, right? But if you don't love the film, it's a lot to sit through. I have to say, 145 minutes, to me, it felt like 10 hours. I thought it would never end. I was willing to pay more money to get out of there, right? Set me free at this point. And this is, you know, joking aside, this is a problem, I think, with a lot of action pictures today, and also with a lot of special effects driven pictures, and they tend to be one and the same increasingly, right? Is that the assumption at the producer's end is that more is better. And I don't think that's always the case. There are so many films where, you know, you're approaching the 2 hour mark and one superhero has punched out the villain. And, you know, you think, well, that's it, or almost it. And no, not yet. You know, we've had climax, now anticlimax, you know, and that now on top of another skyscraper, they're duking it out again. And in other words, essentially not knowing when to quit. And one of the problems I have with F9 is, and we'll talk about the story such as it is, but to stretch that out over, you know, 2.5 hours, that's really pushing it. And I think unless you're a real enthusiast, you really feel at that point, and I'm sorry for the bad puns, but you're kind of spinning wheels, right? You're just sort of going through. And so, you know, you've had 9 films in the franchise plus one spinoff film that came out the other year. And there's only so much you can do with that material, frankly. And I think now they've kind of run out of material. And ironically, they stretch it out even further. So obviously, I'm giving you a thumb down on that, you know, as a film. But you and certainly your date for the evening would give it either a thumb up or, you know, comme ci, comme ça, mienza, mienza. You know, what's your general assessment of the film?
Well, I would say, given the success it's had at the box office, why quit? Because clearly the formula works. But I'm with you 100% on the runtime. I mean, there is some quote out there by somebody who knows what they're talking about, not me, about how you should never give a speech, and I think this extends to movies, that lasts longer than people are willing to sit in a chair before they want to get up, stretch their legs, and go to the bathroom, which turns out to be 2 hours, which is kind of why they settled on that as the amount of time a film should take. I'm always really happy when a movie's like 90 minutes, because I think, oh, good, they've distilled it. You know, it's concise. You're not going to be sitting there noticing the time. You do notice the time in this, because honestly, could they not have gotten all of the, you know, ridiculous plot points in 2 hours? And I think they could have. But I will say this, for people who really like this kind of movie, they showed up when they weren't going to any other movies in the theaters now that they're open. And I've had students since I posted, you know, that I saw it, who've enthusiastically rung in with, I saw it 3 times. So the audience that this is aimed at is going to the movies, and not just once, but multiple times, because the fun of the movies is encapsulated in this kind of movie. Not for me. I mean, I saw it once and I'm fine with it. The reason I went back and watched the other movies is because I realized once I watched a couple of them that, oh, the fun of it isn't in the realism. The fun is in, you know what they're going to do. You know there's going to be car chases. You know it's going to defy physics. There's going to be that moment where even my husband says, oh, come on, because they just defy, you know, the laws of gravity and everything else. And yet the pleasure in those movies is the cameos, like all the famous people that show up. So, you know, you're watching the movie, it's like, oh my God, that's Kurt Russell, or oh my God, that's Helen Mirren, or oh my God, that's whoever. That's part of the fun of the movie. Everybody knows the setup and what's going to happen and, you know, where it's going to go. There's no surprises. It's just how much fun are you going to have getting from point A to point B?
Well, there's no disputing the commercial success of the franchise, but while I'm on that same soapbox, with so much contemporary cinema, it's franchise filmmaking. And even if you like the films or like the franchises, if you will, we've gotten locked into that now. What used to be called tentpole pictures, the big summer releases and so on. Nowadays, you look at the release schedule when we're in normal times in terms of exhibition, and that's what's carrying the industry. So yeah, you can have a superhero movie 1 week and you know, Fast and the Furious the next. And that, you know, one consequence of that, unfortunately, is a lot of smaller pictures not only don't get much distribution, they don't even get made sometimes. I mean, that middle, and particularly the middle of the market, as it used to be called, has pretty much dropped out. And so you just go from one tent pole to the next. Now, the very predictability, the very formulaic quality of films like this is, to put it bluntly, the reason why they're so successful. You go, you know, people sometimes naively say, well, you go because you want to see something you've never seen before. You'd be surprised at that. Well, I would like to believe that, but honestly, I think oftentimes the truth is the opposite. You go for the familiar. You go for what you know. And so the moment you see Vin Diesel, the Laurence Olivier of this genre, the moment you see him, you know exactly what you're going to get, and you get it. And if that's what you want, well, you're a happy customer. I do like happy customers. I'm just not one of them in this particular case. The second aspect of the franchise filmmaking that you find in The Fast and the Furious and in all of the, whether it, you know, better franchises even, you know, the James Bond and Bourne Identity and all those things, better films, I would say, overall. But there as well, what you get is increasingly it's a global marketplace. And you see that reflected in the very story structure, the very story construction of the films. For instance, this is a film that when you come down to it, could probably take place just at a single racetrack. You know, you could finagle it away, or maybe you'd go to another city. But here you go around the world. You go to Tbilisi, Cologne, London, Tokyo, and you even go into outer space. So when Marie earlier mentioned defying the laws of physics, boy, there's Exhibit A right there. And for me, after a while, it wasn't even so much, gee, this is neat, isn't it wonderful? Here's Dom, you know, the Vin Diesel character. He's in outer space now. These guys are flying around the world kind of thing. The thing is, though, I'm almost like when your husband had a comment, like, oh, give me a break or come on, whatever. We all have what I call the breaking point, where in terms of defying the laws of physics or probability, whatever, a lot of the car chases that obviously in real life, you know, would have you calling AAA and mourning the dent in the side of the car and all, it wouldn't be nearly as joyful as the car chases and crashes here. But by the time they're in outer space, it's like, oh, brother. Now, let me double back on my essential point here when some of the characters actually do end up in space. It's just simply that you will have a movie like this touch down around the world. Why does it do that? Well, they finagle a story about world domination, the usual vague, you know, somebody wants to take over the world, they're making a gadget, blah, blah, blah. That also defies all sorts of laws and probabilities. But anyway, there it is as your story. So that becomes the excuse for taking the film itself around the world in 2.5 hours. But what's the pragmatic reason for that? It's what Marie mentioned earlier. It's the marketplace commercially. When you look at the casting of films today and when you look at the location shooting, yeah, I like going to London. I'll go there, you know. But a very, very functional aspect of it is, you know what? There are movie theater audiences in all those cities and all those languages and so on. And it really becomes a marketing maneuver because movies nowadays, actually, for as much money as they'll make in our country, like Fast and the Furious, they make a lot more even overseas. One reason for that is simply when we said there's not a whole lot of dialogue, it's just that action nonstop. Well, you know what? You can sell that around the world. If you don't speak English, not a problem. You understand cars, and here they are chasing each other and some gunshots and explosions. That's a universal language. So whether it's dubbed or subtitled, ultimately is almost a moot point because the film itself has just a meager storyline. The characters we all know from the earlier films, you just get hooked on it. You're watching, it's an adrenaline rush that for people who like it, just goes on for 2.5 hours. So I'm not going to go on for 2.5 hours. I'll turn it back to you.
Well, I will say that given that this was released 20 years after the first Fast and Furious movie, the fact that it's making all this money, you know, you have to stop and think about that. And I think you've hit on it, Mike, that you know what you're getting. Whether you're an American audience or an international audience, you know exactly what you're going in for. And if you were a fan of all the other ones, of course you're going to go and see, well, how much are they going to try to push it this time before you have that oh, come on moment? And I will tell you where the oh, come on moment is for me, is when they're driving across a bridge that then, you know, breaks out from under them. And at one point, the camera is actually on the car, defying gravity, you know, traveling up the remains of the bridge that is falling apart beneath them. It is so ridiculous, but that's why it's fun. I think the part where, you know, realists would say that just ruined the movie because that simply could not happen. It is because it is pitched towards the video game audience that it's because it's ridiculous that it's completely appropriate. And that's the only way you could have shot it because it works on that level.
Here's an argument to make that I would say realism is showing in the theater next door, right? And so, you know, even though it can say, oh, brother, come on, give me a break, this and that. For those who enjoy the film, for whom it's fun, and even for me, who I don't particularly enjoy it, but I've got to smile and giggle sometimes just at how ridiculous it gets. You know, let it defy the laws of physics. It's not going to be a serious film, quote unquote. But where the film, I think, is internally conflicted is it's a yes and no thing. It's totally outrageous, ridiculous. But then there's a storyline. It's meant to be taken seriously on a very sentimental level. In terms of this particular film, Dom Toretto, the Vin Diesel character, has a brother, Jacob, played by John Cena. And the two of them are, to put it mildly, they're on the outs. And you get the backstory. You get flashbacks to growing up with their father. You do find out more or less, what happened between them. And the fact that the brother now is working for the bad guys, basically, the world domination guys. Not only that, but an Eastern European dictator. So there's a bad guy for you. And so you get all that. But at that level, it wants to go tender, right? So you'll have an interlude. They've been chasing each other, explosions, the bridge scene you mentioned. Yeah, and I laughed at that too. I plead guilty. I laughed at it. But, and to turn the argument against myself briefly, in terms of genre, we go to genre pictures because we know the genre, because we want more of the same and seeing how they tweak it. So I plead guilty there. There's just other genres I prefer. Maybe that's the way to put it. But when they go tender, when they go sentimental here, then you have to finally confront the fact that these are, characters. And they're played by actors, and there's no escaping this. You've got to evaluate Vin Diesel as to whether he'll ever get an Academy Award as best actor. It's just, you watch him, and it's painful to watch him as he emotes. For me, that is actual suffering. They're going to have a lot of male bonding in a film like this, right? And sad to say, early on in the series, when Paul Walker, died in a car accident of all things, that was some of the male bonding in the early pictures, and saying farewell to him was valid sentiment. Remember at the end of the one picture where they're like on the beach and they're mourning his loss and so on. That's a real loss as one of the actors who died, in circumstances close to what they have in the film. And so, I'm not joking at all about any of that. But what I'm getting at here is when you have this sibling rivalry, this conflict between Dom and Jacob, in this film, it's really predictable, and I find it actually painful to watch. So ironically, I'd almost wish they would scuttle that and just get back in the car again. What do you think?
I am with you on this. The things that I thought were misses about this, as someone who steeped themselves in the franchise and understood some of what made it work. The Rock is not in this one, if you haven't seen it. If you're expecting to see Dwayne Johnson, he's not in this one. The brother that you never heard about before, really? I mean, oh, come on. I thought that was weak. They bring back a character who was thought to be dead in a previous, Fast and Furious movie. I did like the way they kind of refer to the Paul Walker character as kind of being home watching the kids while Jordana Brewster showed up. That was kind of nice. I do think it's interesting that the Fast and the Furious is, F and F, and so is Ford versus Ferrari, which to me was a better look at, just an excuse to go to the movies to watch a bunch of people racing cars. So briefly, before we move on to our next movie, Mike, what do you think about that? In terms of a car movie, how Ford versus Ferrari dealt with that versus the Fast and Furious franchise?
Well, Ford versus Ferrari is just a much better film on a realistic level. If you really love car racing, and again, I'm not a fan, but if you really love it, it really has some great footage at the track. You know what I mean? And some of it is kind of outrageous, but it's realistic in a way. And the characters are too. It's more grounded that way. So it has a more grounded story, more realistic racing action, and a lot of it. And so I'd say if you really love race cars and that kind of a film, there's no comparison at that level. In terms of how this one is so ridiculous, the F9, when it goes into space, remind me, Marie, isn't it the Tyrese Gibson and Ludacris characters who are like court jesters, right? And suddenly they're like up in space that way. And that's the point where, even though I'm not a big fan of this, I've got to kind of giggle and go along with it. It's so silly at that point. And push come to shove, which scenes would I want? Would I want Dom and Jacob thrashing out their sibling woes, or would I want Tyrese Gibson and Ludacris, whether in outer space or down on the ground, wherever, talking back and forth in a way that's actually making fun of the very franchise? I think, honestly, push come to shove, I'd opt for the silly stuff over the supposed serious emotion. What do you think?
I'm with you, because I think the fans of the genre would get the in-joke and would enjoy the, the spoofing of the very thing that they're enjoying. But let's put a pin in that one. That's, one of the big blockbusters from the summer. But I'd like to talk about the movie that I think is really the summer movie, which is Summer of Soul, which I saw at Sundance and was blown away by, especially understanding that, this is something that happened that, you know, we never even heard about. And when you watch the footage, it is absolutely astonishing. So I want to just sort of open up the discussion for us by, I know you have used in the past the Rolling Stones at Altamont, you know, as a, here's a documentary and all the other things that you're showing. What do you think about this supplanting that as like a completely different look at a documentary about music? What do you think, Mike?
Well, you know, when we talk about summer movies, Summer of Soul is a perfect choice in terms of subject matter. But, you know, what strikes me about it is that, you know, I'm oftentimes recommending films to people. I mean, I as you noticed, I was not recommending F9, right? It's not on my list of things to recommend. People go anyway. They don't listen to me. They go anyway. But in terms of films I recommend, oftentimes I say, well, it's good or it's good, but this is a case where Summer of Soul is not only recommended, I would call it a must-see picture. When it was reviewed in the New York Times the other week, the critic actually said, you know, this is the best movie of the year. I mean, I'm thinking along those lines too. And I could go on for hours about how amazing the footage is in places. Now, to put it in context, in terms of your specific question, I teach courses on documentary film, and I've got a strong interest and have written about music. And, you know, a lot of the people that are in this film, I've either interviewed or certainly seen in concerts. I mean, I've got connections to, you know, some of the concert acts that way. Directly to your question, however, think about this. It's the, you know, summer of 69. In terms of major music events, concerts, what do we all remember? Well, there was Woodstock in August of 69, and the resulting documentary film came out the following year and is well worth seeing, of course. And then Altamont occurred in December. The first concert, of course, Woodstock in upstate New York, Altamont in the Bay Area in California. This sounds glib, it sounds flip, but it's really a lot of truth in this, namely that people say that the 60s reached its peak with Woodstock, everything it represented and so on. And then it crashed and burned just 4 months later with the Altamont concerts, you know, with the Hells Angels acting true to their name for the Rolling Stones event there. Now, in a course I teach, or in various courses I've taught, I've seen Gimme Shelter, the Maisels Brothers documentary about Altamont. I've seen it more than 100 times, so I know the film pretty well. It's my favorite rock music documentary. It's still my favorite. You know, my second favorite, if you will, is the Bob Dylan film that D.A. Pennebaker did, Don't Look Back. So, I mean, I've got like a few at the top of the list, but pushing personal favorites aside, what I would say about Summer of Soul is, in a kind of sociological sense, it's interesting to me that when people talk about those concerts in the late 60s, specifically Woodstock and Altamont, there's a lot of attention paid there. This particular concert was actually a series of six concerts given from June through August. My major reservation, my only real reservation about Summer of Soul as a film, and it's terrifically well made, but it is a serious reservation for me, is we need to hear more about it. We need to hear a bit more about the backstory. Very briefly in the film, I mean, like just a matter of seconds, they actually flash onto the concert schedule, you know, like week by week, who was performing. It's an astounding lineup of talent, believe me. But the thing is, within the film itself, the editing, which is so deft and interesting in various ways, ironically, as you're watching it, you don't really have a sense of, well, was she in the first week or the last week? Were these two acts back to back? It doesn't matter in terms of an experience enjoying it, but you would kind of like to know. And the film, I think, should devote another 5 or 10 minutes to showing you the actual, pragmatically, you know, showing you the schedule. Here's what it was. People we hear and don't hear within the film, that's a lot of footage. And then the second thing that there should be more of is when this film was shot in the summer of 69, well, I mean, I knew about the concerts because I'm familiar with these concert acts, and you read about them or write about them, and you know that they were performing in Harlem in the summer of 69, but I didn't know too much about it because what happened was they shot all this footage, and then, my goodness, it just sat in cans in somebody's basement. Finally, Questlove from the Roots rescued the footage and showed it. The final thing I'll say before turning back to Marie is, you know, within the film, there are so many great moments. And to see it in a movie theater, which is where I saw it, the highlight of the film is when Mahalia Jackson and Mavis Staples sing Take My Hand, Precious Lord. At the end of that sequence, the audience in the theater applauded like it was a live concert. And at the very end of the film, there was a big round of applause. And one man in the back of the theater shouted, I was there. I didn't get a chance to find him or talk to him, but, you know, imagine that experience, watching it with somebody who's actually at these concerts in Harlem. Marie, let me turn it back to you, because we should at least mention some of the people who perform, and my goodness, it's a great, great lineup of talent.
It's actually staggering. And that's why when you say, you know, this footage has been lost for so long, you're saying to yourself, why? Because it's a 19-year-old Stevie Wonder opening. And then it goes on to Mahalia Jackson and B.B. King and Nina Simone and Gladys Knight and the Pips and Sly and the Family Stone rocking some serious, you know, psychedelic 60s garb. It's so much fun to be part of. That's the part that shocks you that it hasn't been released before this, because it's so much fun to take part in. Now, they talk about it as being like the Black Woodstock, that all the acts were, you know, on stage just for the joy of performing for free. And you get that sense when you're watching it. But I agree with you. There's no sense you have that this was something that spread out over 6 days. It's not shot that way where it's like day one, you know, who's on the bandstand, day two, day three, et cetera. It's all of a piece.
But it was six concerts over the summer from June through August. So not even every week. They were spaced out. And what's good about it is Questlove is really smart in a socioeconomic way. He places you there. He has interviews with the people, you know, years later. They look at the footage. We listen to them, both performers and audience members, as they look at the old footage. The reason it wasn't edited and released then, and it is pointed out too quickly in the film, is that no producer thought it was commercially viable. Thought, I mean, that's an astounding thing to contemplate, but nobody thought it would be a moneymaker. Speaking of commercial prospects, it just sat in cans and in the basement, if you will. But what's great is, in a socioeconomic sense, it's the same summer as the moon landings. And in the interviews done at the concert grounds, asking people, how do you feel about the moon landings, which just occurred? People saying, well, you know, the white people spent a lot of money to put somebody on the moon. I wish they'd spend some money on Black people in Harlem. There are great quotes in this film, both from people on the ground in 69, and now, decades later, watching the footage and commenting on what it was like to be there.
I agree. I thought that was one of the most powerful points, was that they were interviewing people at the time about what they thought, not going back to ask people what they thought in retrospect. Just at the time, they were saying, well, it kind of seems like a waste of money when, you know, we've got real problems here. But I will say this, I thought the high point was Oh Happy Day. When they're actually playing Oh Happy Day, when I was watching it, I just felt transported. I thought, this is just an amazing moment in music. I couldn't believe it had taken them that long to get around to sharing that with everybody. So I can't say enough about how much I regard this film. It was one of the highlights from Sundance, just that this is what movies are meant to do, to take stuff that has actually been archived and, you know, presented in a way where everybody gets to enjoy it. So unqualified recommendation for this movie. If you can catch it in the theaters, do. If all you can do is watch it on your own TV while you stream it when it's available, do that, because the music stands up beautifully and it's really just a tour de force, which actually brings us now to the end of our episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes of At the Movies with Mike and Marie at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio with Pandora and Spotify. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.